Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. Later on in this hour, we'll have a panel discussion on the prospect of office to residential conversions as a way to revitalize downtown San Francisco. And producer Ann Harper will sit down with local author William G. Wong about his new book, Sons of Chinatown, a memoir rooted in China and America. But first, I'm pleased to be joined by Jeff Tumlin, director of the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency, or MTA, to talk about the Valencia Street Center bike lane, which has been the source of a lot of controversy. So welcome back to State of the Bay, Jeff Tumlin.
Thank you, Ethan. It's good to be on KALW.
Well, we're always happy to have you. And we also want to welcome our listeners. We're opening the phone lines a bit early. If you have questions and comments on what should be happening on Valencia Street to make it safer, you can give us a call. We're at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also find us on social media or email us with any questions or comments for this segment at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Well, first of all, Jeff, let's just start with what the impetus was for putting a center bike lane on Valencia Street in the first place.
Right. Well, Valencia has for decades been the most important north-south bikeway in the city. All the streets to the west are too steep, and the streets to the east don't connect. So Valencia is flat, and it has 82.5 feet. So it's where the bikeway made sense. But it's also an incredibly interesting, vibrant, quirky neighborhood commercial district. It's also long been one of the deadliest streets in San Francisco. Pre-COVID, we were getting 2 severe injury crashes per month, just in the central blocks of the street. So we knew we needed to change something. And the challenge was, how do we make Valencia Street safe for everyone and allow the commercial district to thrive? So before COVID, we did side-running protected bikeway from Market Street south to 15th. It was also very controversial, and it worked really well. But then COVID happened. And what happened after COVID was about 60 parklets that we helped support neighborhood merchants to get through the worst of COVID. And what also happened was a huge uptick in curbside pickup and drop-off from DoorDash and Amazon and other delivery services, most of which was happening in the bikeway. So we knew we wanted to continue the success of the side-running protected bikeway south from 15th, but the parklets were in the way. And so we looked at the street and we said, okay, it's an atypical design, but let's experiment with a center-running bikeway. And that's what we did. And it was successful in achieving its goals. But as everyone knows, it also created some unintended consequences that we're now dealing with.
Well, so you say it was successful in achieving its goals. Can you talk about what that success has been so far?
Well, the success has mainly been eliminating that huge conflict between curbside pickup and drop-off and people using bikes. And solved that problem, but created some other problems. Like confusion for motorists, like the fact that anyone wanting to back into an existing curbside parking space would block all traffic, like restrictions on left turns. And all of that, the merchants felt damaged the unique brand of the Valencia corridor. And so there is widespread agreement among the merchants that it's time to relook at our original proposal, which was side-running protected bikeway.
And how is that going? Or how is the process of thinking about switching it over to the side, or switching it back to the side, really going? And what would that entail, given that it seems like the dynamic of parklets and curbside drop-off has not abated since the pandemic ended?
That's right. So there still is a need for parklets. There's a huge need for curbside pickup and drop-off. And right now we are working with almost every individual merchant in the corridor to figure out how to design the street down to the nearest inch in order to make things safe for people on bikes, for pedestrians, for people in wheelchairs and motorists, and support all of the different needs for the merchants and their customers, and support emergency service and fire access. So that's an intense amount of staff work that is going merchant by merchant. And one of the things that we're exploring with merchants is to learn from the success in Oakland and in New York about having some of those parklets go what we call floating, where the bikeway would go between the parklet and the sidewalk. And there's a lot of nervousness about this, just like there was in Oakland and New York. But we're finding that it's been far more successful in those cities than they had expected, and in many ways achieves the goal. Because if we can have the bikeway go between the parklet and the sidewalk, it also means we can save a lot of curbside parking. And that's one of the things that we're trying to maximize in the 82 and a half feet of the street.
And you mentioned that the Valencia Street Merchants Association, the businesses along the corridor, really want to see this change from the bike lanes moving out of the center of Valencia Street onto the side with these, you know, kind of floating types of bike lanes like you're describing. What about the bikers themselves? What have you been hearing from people who bicycle down this corridor? What do they want to see?
Yeah, well, so the feedback has been mixed. In fact, very divergent opinions. A lot of the more active bike activists have been continually opposed to the center running experiment. When we actually talk to cyclists on the street, particularly less experienced cyclists, they really appreciate the center running lane and they like it better than the side running lane north of 15th. But what we know is that we need a compromise that doesn't get anyone everything that they want so that everyone can get everything that they need. And that will likely mean, a tight side running bikeway design that kind of helps to optimize all of the objectives we're trying to achieve.
And just to remind listeners, we're speaking with Jeff Tumlin, director of the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency, or SFMTA. And Jeff, you just mentioned that Valencia Street has been part of the city's high injury network. You referenced some of the high accident rates there on Valencia Street. In terms of just safety, what would be the safest approach? Is there a way to ensure that there's not going to be an increase in collisions, accidents by moving the bike lanes over to the back to the side?
Well, side-running protected bikeways are a proven design. We have them on many streets in San Francisco, like Howard and Folsom, and Valencia north of 15th and south of Cesar Chavez. So we know about how that design works and how to make sure that we can make things safe, particularly at intersections where there are still conflicts with left and right turning motor vehicles. We also want to make sure that the street is safe for pedestrians. And we know that if we tighten up the dimensions of the street, that motorists will travel more slowly, and slower motor vehicle speeds make things safer for everyone.
Well, we have an email in from Jane who writes, many European cities keep it simple. Bike lanes adjacent to pedestrian lanes are painted a contrasting color. In Amsterdam, bikes have the right of way over both vehicles and pedestrians. And Jane writes, can that happen here too?
Well, we're learning from successes from cities all over the world, including Latin American cities, and how to get the design details right, and also how to do it in a way that we can afford. As I hope all of you know, the SFMTA is still in the worst financial crisis in its history. We lost $40 million a year from our capital budget and about $200 million a year from our operating budget. So we're also continuing to do things with very low cost materials that we can implement in-house as we continue to refine these designs and as we pursue real funding in order to deliver a safe and carbon neutral transportation system for everyone in San Francisco.
And of course, not the idea that would maybe mimic what we see in Europe and parts of Latin America is this idea that's been floated to actually close Valencia to car traffic completely. Is that on the table? Is that viable?
Well, we're doing three different projects at the same time for Valencia. We're continuing to refine our details about how we manage parking and curbside loading and commercial loading, as well as wayfinding and signage on the street right now. The second study is planning to change the street over to side running in the coming months. And then the third study is a long-term study that is really about placemaking and entirely reinventing Valencia. That looks at options like having it be car-free, either certain times of day or days of week. It would look at whether the street should be one way in order to create more space. And it looks at how we work with all of the diverse merchants in the corridor to make sure that they can get their customers and their deliveries there at all times of day and night. It's a very complex street, and getting the design details right is going to take a lot of compromise and a lot of work.
And Jeff, you mentioned drawing on inspiration from other countries, from Oakland. Are there any MTA success stories that you're drawing on in terms of the outreach, the process, and the design here?
Well, we're doing this process kind of unlike any other street or any project that we've done this scale, in that we're trying to move very quickly, but also engage with every single merchant along with residents and users of the street. So that is, it's taking a lot of effort. We've got basically the entire streets team on this project to make sure we can get the design details right. And we're particularly grateful to our partners in the San Francisco Fire Department, who've been incredibly creative at working with us on the details in order to make sure that they can access every building while also meeting the needs of the merchants and the other street users.
And so we just got about a minute left here. I'm curious what the next steps in the process are if people want to get involved. And related question, if this does get approved, how long would it actually take to move the lanes over to the side?
Well, for details, go to sfmta.com/Valencia, and you can click a button to sign up for updates as well as get project information. We'll be presenting the project to the SFMTA Board of Directors tomorrow afternoon, where we're seeking direction to transition to the side running lane. And finally, we're trying to figure out when is the optimal time to do the construction, because we would need to first remove everything that's there and remove the paint and then put things back. And that will take a couple weeks per block. And many of the merchants don't want us to do that work during their busy summer season, and others don't want us to do it during the holiday season. So we're trying to figure out together with the merchants when is the optimal time to do that work, either later this year or at the beginning of 2025 after the holiday season.
All right, so this could be happening pretty quickly, so we definitely urge any listeners who care about this issue to get involved and maybe check out that hearing that's going to be happening tomorrow. We're going to have to leave it there, but thank you so much for joining us. That's MTA Director Jeff Tumlin. It's great to have you on State of the Bay.
Thank you.
And coming up next on State of the Bay, our panel of experts will discuss the challenges and opportunities posed by the prospect of turning downtown San Francisco's vacant offices into much-needed housing. That's right after the break, so stay with us.
Get ready to get your laugh on for Pride. Hi, I'm Janae Darden, and you're invited to the Sights and Sounds Pride Comedy Show, featuring comedians Rhea Kapoor, Marcus Williams, Frida Sierra, and country artist Cindy Epsch. That's the Sights and Sounds Pride Comedy Show on Tuesday, June 25th. The venue is 220 Montgomery in San Francisco. Doors open at 6. Show starts at 7. This is for adults only. Visit KALW.org for free tickets.
Hey, this is Ben Trefney, executive producer at KALW. This week on the Tuesday Night Special, listen to the first debate featuring the five top candidates running for mayor of San Francisco: London Breed, Mark Farrell, Daniel Lurie, Aaron Peskin, and Asha Safai. It was conducted live in person on Wednesday before a full house at the Sydney Goldstein Theater. You can hear what happened on this week's Tuesday Night Special, tomorrow at 7 o'clock, right here on KALW, San Francisco Bay Area.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. We want you to be a part of this next conversation. We're going to be talking about turning vacant offices into housing. So are you a developer who has considered a conversion project? Do you think the city should further reduce barriers to make these kinds of conversions faster and cheaper to do? We're going to open the phone lines now so you can give us a call. We're at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also find us on social media or email us with any of your thoughts or questions on this issue at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Well, office to residential conversions in San Francisco's downtown have been touted as a solution to both our housing needs and our persistent office vacancy problem. But is this financially viable for developers to do? Should the city and state loosen more of its rules to help accelerate the process? And is adding housing the solution to our hollowed out downtown, or should we be preserving downtown office space and our business district? Here to help us unpack all of this, we're very pleased to be joined by Sujata Srivastava, Chief Policy Officer for SPUR, formerly SPUR's Planning and Housing Policy Director, and author of From Workspace to Home Base. Welcome, Sujata.
Thank you.
And we're pleased to be joined by State Assembly Member Phil Ting, who has represented District 19 since 2012 and authored legislation to facilitate office to residential conversions. Welcome, Assembly Member Ting.
Thanks for having me.
And last but not least, we're very pleased to be joined by Mark Babson, principal at San Francisco residential property developer Emerald Fund. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
So thank you all for joining us for this conversation. We know San Francisco desperately needs housing. As we've covered on the show, the state is requiring the city to build 82,000 new residential units by 2031. And at the same time, downtown San Francisco still has a 36% office vacancy rate. So this office to residential conversion idea seems to solve potentially both of these problems. But Sujata, in your report for SPUR, you note that there's a number of barriers to this conversion process that's keeping this from happening on its own. Can you just describe for our listeners what are some of the basic challenges to converting vacant office to housing?
Sure. Thank you. So for our report, we actually contracted with Gensler, a national architecture firm. And then we also had some economic analysis, which the Emerald Fund assisted us with, as well as Sylvan Development Group and HRNA. And what we found was there was a mix of both physical, regulatory, and economic barriers. The physical barriers are just that not all office buildings are well suited to becoming residential units because their floor plates might be awkward. They don't have operable windows. Sometimes the, you know, elevators and other kinds of issues need to be upgraded. Oftentimes seismic upgrades are required. So all of those pose a challenge for being able to convert them. We found that 40% of the buildings in San Francisco could potentially be good candidates for conversion, which is about twice as many as you find in other North American cities. So you could maybe solve for some of the physical issues, but then you have some regulatory issues. So there are some existing city regulations that make it really difficult and expensive to convert office spaces. And the cost of doing those upgrades is significant. It's cheaper to do a conversion than a new construction in a new high-rise residential tower. And yet it still doesn't quite pencil out with today's construction costs, interest rates, and rents. So there are some levers that can be pulled on the policy side and also by providing some economic incentives. This is how a lot of other cities have accelerated office to residential conversions and been able to diversify their downtowns.
Well, Sujata, let's talk about some of those policy levers because you describe four of them in the SPUR report. Can you just explain what they are briefly?
Yeah, well, some of them are just about cleaning up the planning and building codes so that it's a lot easier to do by right for most projects. You don't have to go through a cumbersome process. In San Francisco, historically, the planning process has really been time consuming. And so just whatever you can do to streamline that process and get the permitting going makes a big difference. There were some things like changing the open space requirements and how many units in that building needed to be three bedrooms versus one bedroom. Those kinds of things that make it really hard when you're looking at a conversion and you're trying to make a lot of compromises. So having more flexibility in the codes is number one. Another piece of it is trying to really think about what the seismic standards are going to be for those types of buildings. If there are ways that we can make sure that all of our life safety requirements are being met, but that we're not creating standards that are too onerous for these buildings. Another piece of it is really looking at those financial levers. So right now, the city's inclusionary requirement, which is how many of the units need to be affordable, is 15% for new development projects. That makes a lot of sense for new construction, where you can take advantage of things like the state density bonus and other types of tools that allow you to build more on a site. But when you have an existing building envelope and you're trying to put in those 15% inclusionary units, it's a real financial cost. So we have really looked at what the potential is to reduce some of those inclusionary requirements so that you can make those projects more feasible. And then finally, looking at really creative tax incentives that the city could be providing in terms of lowering the real estate transfer tax, which the voters just approved for conversion projects, and also thinking about tax increment financing. So this is basically taking the base value of the building, the tax that's currently assessed on underutilized office buildings. Once they are redeveloped into higher value residential buildings, that increment, which is known as the property tax increment, could be redirected to those conversion projects to make them more feasible. So those are some of the tools that we talked about in our report.
And Mark Babson, your firm, Emerald Fund, has actually done one of these conversions. You successfully converted a building on Van Ness into residences back in 2015. How are you looking at the market now for downtown housing? Do you feel that this is something that could be viable to have more downtown offices converted into condos and apartments, just generally speaking?
Yeah, it certainly could be. There's a lot of interest in housing in San Francisco and a lot of interest in revitalizing downtown. The key is making the numbers work. In 2015, we actually bought it out in 2012. Construction costs were about 70% less than they are today. And the rents were about the same as they are today. So just the math doesn't work. But as Sujata was saying, there are some levers that the local government, the local and state government control that could be pulled that could result in actual conversions. If property taxes and the affordable housing levers are pulled, I think we're going to see a lot of conversions because it will be the only thing that actually works. Right now, we're seeing no housing development in San Francisco because the numbers simply don't work.
So, Mark, it sounds like those would be the two changes that you would need to see put in place, the affordability requirements and the property taxes. Would you think that those dealing with those two challenges would unlock a lot of conversions potentially?
Correct. Yeah, we initially had a transfer tax on the list, but that was Measure C that was passed by voters this last March. And also historic buildings that qualify for historic tax credits would be more likely to happen. But when we look around the country, it's property taxes and affordable housing that are the levers that are being pulled in New York and Boston, Minneapolis, Chicago, and Assemblymember Ting's legislation. It just hits the nail right on the head. It's exactly what we want to see. So we're strong supporters of that legislation.
Well, I appreciate you name-checking Assemblymember Ting. I was just about to ask him about that legislation. So Assemblymember Ting, you did introduce legislation AB 2488, which would help create financial incentives for these conversion projects. Can you talk about your bill, where it is in the process, and why you settled on this approach?
Thanks so much, Ethan, for having us on the air and really having this important discussion. The reason for the bill, as Mark and Sujata talked about, was really to primarily focus on getting people back downtown. One of the major issues that we see, we could build housing in a variety of different parts of San Francisco, but what the bill does is really focus on how do we incentivize the conversion of office building into residential with the focus of getting more people in downtown 24/7. That's one of the biggest challenges. We're not going to be able to dictate or force people back into office buildings. The work patterns have completely changed, but we believe that if we can get more residential housing in downtown, that'll create a more vibrant community. And so what the bill really does is it allows the city to draw a district similar to like a redevelopment district where the 50% of the buildings are office buildings and there's at least 20% of the buildings are vacant. And so it's high concentration of office. So this can't be drawn to the Mission or the Sunset or the Marina. This is really to focus on downtown and also with a high percent of vacancy. And what the hope is to do what Sujata talked about, which is to do a tax increment tool, which basically all it says is, if your building is valued at $1 million today, and that's what the value is. And then after you do your you do your conversion, that building is now valued at $3 million, then you would take the excess property tax between the $3 to $1 million and set that aside and really be able to use that as a tool to incentivize more conversion. And I think when people think about converting office to housing, they go, oh, are we going to turn the Transamerica building into an apartment building? Are we going to turn the B of A building into an apartment building? And I think really most of those modern buildings are not really going to be able to be converted. So with Mark and Emerald Fund's conversion, it was a, you know, older office space. It was not something, it was decades old. So I think the older office space really is a much better fit. And the smaller office space, you're not going to see what you would think of as the main core buildings like One Market or Salesforce Tower all of a sudden be converted into office. It's really going to be a lot of the older buildings that are smaller and a little bit more nondescript in downtown San Francisco.
And Assemblymember Tink, so far, does Bill seem to have the support it needs? I know you've got to go to the state Senate and the governor would have to sign it. Are you getting the sense that this is going to pass and become law?
Well, we're hopeful. We got it out of the Assembly. We're in the Senate right now. We're starting in local government. And obviously, when you start over with committees, you have new committee chairs, new committee consultants, and they're giving us their feedback. We also loosened the affordability requirements to make sure that we didn't have some of the affordability requirements, because we thought just starting out initially, like Mark had said, that the developers really wouldn't be able to afford, you know, to be able to make it affordable right off the bat. That affordability could come down the line, but not immediately. But I'm hopeful that we can get out of the Senate and get it to the governor. And again, this is right now a bill just for San Francisco. We're hoping that we can get this started in San Francisco. And I bet if we're successful, then other cities like LA will follow.
Well, I was going to ask if there's interest in places like downtown LA, downtown Oakland. There's a lot of downtown environments, maybe San Diego as well, that could use this. Are you hearing from those cities as well that they would like to see a similar approach?
You know, we haven't yet, but I bet, again, people tend to follow San Francisco's lead for better or for worse. And so I imagine that if this bill goes through, people start thinking about it. You know, Mark starts talking to other developers around the state. I bet there'll be interest.
Well, if you're just joining us, this is State of the Bay on local public radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're discussing turning vacant offices in downtown San Francisco into housing. Do you think the city should further incentivize these conversions? Do you think San Francisco should preserve its business district for offices just in case there's a new boom? We'd love to hear from you. The number to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. And we're very pleased to be joined by a panel for this particular conversation, Sujata Srivastava, Chief Policy Officer for SPUR, State Assembly Member Phil Ting, who has represented District 19 here in the city since 2012 and is authoring legislation to facilitate office to residential conversions, and Mark Babson, Principal at San Francisco Residential Property Developer Emerald Fund. Well, we have an email in from Tara, who writes, can manufacturing or retail spaces be converted to housing as well, or is it just offices? So Sujata, I'd like to direct that one to you.
Yeah, absolutely. Manufacturing spaces, we have actually a lot of history of a lot of the industrial areas, particularly in South of Market area. And now increasingly you're seeing that happening in Dogpatch. I mean, Mission Bay was mostly an industrial area. A lot of that has slowly changed over to primarily residential uses. With retail spaces, there are some challenges sometimes with ground floor spaces becoming residential. But I think that in many situations for some of the larger retail formats, there could be some interesting conversion opportunities. It really does depend a little bit on the building type, and we haven't studied it as closely as we have with the office spaces.
And Sujata, just staying with you, what can we learn from other places that have been able to make this transition successfully? Places like Lower Manhattan or Calgary, which have been able to repurpose their buildings. What are some of the lessons that San Francisco and potentially other cities in California could draw from those experiences?
Yeah, thank you for asking that question. We did do some case studies in our report looking at other cities and how they've been able to have success with office to residential conversions. And what the biggest takeaway is that none of it happens through market forces alone. You do need to have some level of public sector involvement and investment. So in the case of Lower Manhattan, the state and the city worked together to provide a property tax abatement that really catalyzed a lot of those conversions. Right now in New York, office to residential conversions do not have an inclusionary affordability requirement if they aren't seeking any kind of incentive. If they seek an incentive, then that sort of kicks in. So there's a sort of recognition of like, we're not going to try to penalize privately driven projects if they are seeking a significant amount of public resources, then we may think about what the right amount of affordability would be. And that's something that they did after Lower Manhattan had become successful without any intervention on affordability requirements, but with a significant amount of public sector investments. In Calgary, they actually have a program where the city provides grant amounts, essentially, of $75 per square foot for those office conversions. They had a huge glut of office buildings because there was a crash in the energy sector. And so they had a similar structural change in their market where they just had a lot of vacancies in their office space. And so they were able to turn that around through this program. And I think what's important about their case study is that they understood that taking out some of that vacant, obsolete space, as Assemblymember Ting described, you know, those older, smaller buildings helps the existing buildings do better. So
that's sort of
this
a pioneering effect there.
Exactly. You're just kind of taking out that stuff that doesn't really contribute to the market and just drags it down. You're reactivating it with more people, more eyes on the street, and more customers to support small businesses. And that really kind of helps all of the other office owners and tenants and employees and visitors to thrive.
Well, Mark Babson, I'd like to know from your perspective, from the development side, which buildings do you tend to look at as being the most eligible from a market perspective to be converted? We do have this number that 13% of San Francisco's office buildings could be considered viable candidates. So what would you be looking for as to whether or not an office building might be suitable?
We've looked at maybe a dozen or so buildings so far, and a lot of them are suitable, surprisingly. But the biggest thing is windows, right? People, apartments have more of a need for windows than office buildings. So not a super deep floor plate. Also windows that are not directly facing another building so people can bring in light and air. And if it has a view, even better. 100 Van Ness has great views. We also look at where the elevator is located. If it's a center core, we like that because usually it's the deepest space on the floor plate is the least amount of light. So, and 100 Van Ness had this, had elevators in the middle and not too deep of units. And then we look at, you know, the area, like a lot of downtown, a lot of south of Market has activity going on. It's maybe it's near the Embarcadero or it's near cafes or it's near art museum. So kind of look at where people want to be and hopefully those all come together. And then if we do get these levers of the reduced property taxes and the reduced affordability, I think it works.
Well, and Mark, does demand need to sort of prove itself in downtown San Francisco? I mean, is there a thought that maybe people wouldn't want to live downtown, particularly if they're kind of pioneering being residents in a place that otherwise is pretty quiet at this point, if not pretty much derelict in certain parts of the area of the downtown area? I mean, is there some of this about just trying to see if people even want to live downtown, or do you feel confident enough that there are areas that people would want to make it their home?
Yeah, we feel quite confident. There are a number of residential buildings downtown. There have been for many years. There are a bunch of new ones were built kind of in the last wave. And so people do like downtown. It's not just for the proximity to their jobs, but it's proximity to transit, proximity to the water, proximity to the ferry building, proximity to bike lanes. There are already a lot of people living down there. It's dominated by office, but that doesn't mean the residential is not there.
And Assemblymember Ting, we have an email in from Pamela that I'd like to direct to you. Pamela writes, I thought that London Breed was bringing in an historical black college or even a UC campus into downtown San Francisco. Is that happening? Does your panel think those are good ideas? And Assemblymember Ting, starting with you, I've also heard about potentially bringing some research laboratories downtown. What's the sort of bigger picture for downtown revitalization where office to residential could play a part in that?
Yeah, I think you'll have to ask the mayor's office about that. So in terms of, I think, what is possible, you look at something like the Westfield Mall. The Westfield Mall used to have San Francisco State College of Extended Learning. That could be an opportunity for the Westfield Mall. I think there are opportunities to bring in universities to teach classes or to do what's called extensions, which is typically geared toward professional folks who really want to take classes and continue to develop their skills. Having said that, one of the challenges is if you are, we're going to have a downtown campus, is housing. So you would want to marry the downtown classroom space with housing because you wouldn't necessarily want classes in downtown San Francisco, but then no students living there. And so I think that while that is one of the possible scenarios for downtown, especially to replace retail, I think those discussions still seem like they are quite far away.
And we have a question from listener Gregory on your bill, Assemblymember Ting, who says there's more to creating a safe, vibrant, sustainable, attractive residential area than just creating houses. How does this bill create community resources and amenities rather than a residential ghetto? And that's in Gregory's words there. So Assemblymember Ting, what are your thoughts and response?
Well, again, you know, what you see, just to look at the inverse, is if you don't have any people in a particular neighborhood, what tends to happen? Well, you have blight, you have crime, things start to happen in that particular neighborhood that really don't encourage people to either want to live there or go to work there or go to eat or go out. So being able to get people into a place is the first step. Afterwards, you definitely want to look at opportunities to create community, whether that is through different organizations, whether that's through different social groups, whether that is through different kinds of services. But I think getting the people there is paramount. When you have no people there, then it doesn't really matter. But going back to Mark's point, there's already quite a bit of housing in downtown. You look at the Golden Gateway Center right by the Embarcadero. You can look at many of the housing projects around Market Street or in South of Market that are were built or being built or have been built. And so there is housing, but I think in the core, what we think of as downtown, which is now north of Market, you know, north of Market is a traditional downtown. There really isn't as much, and you're seeing because of that a lot of small businesses closing, businesses that really cater to a lot of the downtown office workers not being able to survive. So I think it's really trying to figure out how do you bring people into that part of the corridor and ensure that we can have more people there, create a safer environment, but also help back up our small businesses.
And Assemblymember Ting, not to get too far ahead of ourselves, but let's say your bill is able to pass addressing some of the financial challenges. What else do you think would you like to see the state do to try to increase housing production? We've talked about that 82,000 housing unit goal or requirement that San Francisco has. What else do you think needs to be done that you would like to see done?
Well, I think the state's done a lot since I've been in the legislature over 12 years. We've streamlined affordable housing. I just did a bill that really limits local government's abilities to hold or stop housing. I've done bills around streamlining accessory dwelling units. We've also done bills to really make it easier to build along transit corridors. So I think that the state has really said to local governments, local government's response has been, hey, we're in charge of housing. We got this. What we see is based on the increase in homelessness and the lack of housing construction, we say, no, you don't have this. And so we've been really trying to find different tools to get more housing built more quickly. And so I think that trend will continue at the state level. We continue to not make nearly as much progress as we'd like in chipping away at about a 2 million home gap. Homelessness keeps going up. And so we know that building more housing is not the only answer, but it's a major piece of the puzzle. So again, we're going to continue to do that. I imagine my colleagues will continue to do that in the years to come. And we're going to be looking at ways to make sure that San Francisco isn't just building housing, it's really every other city. And that's really kind of what you're referring to, Ethan. We have goals for every single city along affordable housing, middle-class housing, higher income housing, or market rate housing. And we want to make sure that every city is really participating in that. And boy, the cities that have really been stopping housing for quite a number of years, they are squawking pretty hard. Some of them are being sued by the state to make sure that they are doing their part. In San Francisco, we think we've done, you know, a decent job on the market rate side, a decent job. And, you know, like we'd like to do better on the affordable, but there's still much more housing to be built in San Francisco, too.
And Sujata, I want to ask you about opposition. Is there organized opposition or just general opposition to these conversions? Is there a thought that maybe it's better to leave them as offices in case somehow that office market were to rebound? We just have a couple minutes left, so just curious for your quick take on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that generally there's a lot of support for the idea of creating a more diverse, mixed downtown. What we do get sometimes is from fiscal hawks some concern over this type of public investment. But I think we really need to look at it as exactly that, an investment that will be better for the city in the long term.
And Mark, we've talked a bit about, well, we've talked a fair amount about State Assembly Member Ting's bill and some of the approaches at the city level. What else would you like to see happen? I mean, if you could maybe talk about different levels of government, is there a role for the federal government here? Are there other issues that leaders aren't addressing that in a perfect world you'd like to see addressed to see these conversions happen more rapidly?
There is another thing on the list. So the federal government has historic tax credits for federal taxes, but the state passed a bill a few years ago, but has never funded it. And so I think that's another tool to access state tax credits that could help these projects get closer to feasibility.
All right.
And one thing I do want to note, all the taxes we're talking about in the affordable housing, this is all bonus. Like if the project, if the office building isn't renovated, there's no additional taxes. So this is all kind of playing with house money. And it's saying, hey, for a period of time, we'll refund some of this extra money. But then in the long run, it goes to the city coffers.
Well, I appreciate this discussion. It's such a critical issue. The downtown environment is really the center of our economy and much of our cultural life. So I appreciate all of you coming on. We're going to have to leave it there, but thanks so much for joining us. That's a state assembly member, Phil Ting, Sujata Srivastava of Spur, and Mark Babson of the Emerald Fund. Thank you all three of you for joining us for this discussion.
Thanks so
much. Thank you.
And coming up after the break, producer Ann Harper talks to author William G. Wong about his new book, Sons of Chinatown. We'll be right back just after this.
Tune in to Cross Currents tomorrow morning at 11. We meet a molecular biologist who is bringing African dance and music to schools.
My earliest memories are music, dancing, song, all ingrained as part of our day-to-day lives and activities.
A conversation on African dance, music, and cultural diplomacy. That's tomorrow morning at 11 on Cross Currents from KALW News.
Do you love the music you hear on KALW? You want to get to know your favorite DJ more? How about shows we're presenting or being the first to learn about special ticket giveaways? Well, you can do all that with the KALW Music Newsletter. Go to kalw.org/newsletter and subscribe now.
William G. Wong was born in Oakland's Chinatown in 1941, the only son of his father. He was born in China and emigrated to America in 1912, during the Chinese exclusion era. His father owned a restaurant, which he ran successfully for years, and William, known as Bill, went on to become a journalist, working with local and national news organizations for decades. It sounds like a picture-perfect immigrant success story, but both Bill and his father faced hardship and discrimination. In his new book, Sons of Chinatown, a memoir rooted in China and America, Bill weaves his story together with his father's, giving us insight into the many struggles and joys faced by Asian Americans in our country. We're so pleased to have him here tonight. Welcome to Save the Bay, Bill.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So you grew up in Oakland's Chinatown. I was wondering if you could take us on a walk.
through Oakland's Chinatown when you were, say, 10 or 11 years old. What was it like then?
Well, I call it my Chinatown bubble, and the number of blocks that Chinatown was then and still is was very comfortable, safe, never felt threatened by the outside world. So it was really, and I describe in my book, I was covered in a yellow blanket.
That's great. Now, your book opens with a description of the trip that you made back to China to your father's ancestral village. And you talk about the emotions around that trip. Can you tell us about that visit and how it impacted you?
Right. My sisters and I have long been interested in my father's beginnings, and a few of us knew the early years of them, but most of us who were born in Oakland didn't. So in 1994, a group of us went, found the village, and my first impression was to see how my two older sisters who were born there felt. But I suddenly felt myself attached because I was unable to control my emotions when I went into my father's dilapidated house. So that's when I said to myself, who was Pop and who am I? And that kind of continued my journey on my identity search and to find out more about my father's beginning. So it was a very emotional, yet also energizing and stimulating trip that finally led to the book, Sons of Chinatown.
And had your father described the village much to you? Did you have an idea of what it was going to be like before you went there?
Not at all. It was one of my older sisters who was born there who remembered it. She was one of our main sources of understanding the village. So it was great for us, those of us who weren't there, to see it ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And what was the village like?
Very isolated, one paved street, maybe 25 to 30 abodes, some other buildings, but it was quite dilapidated, at least my father's home was. And it had a nice pond where we saw a water buffalo. And then we saw some people just outside the village working the rice fields. So here was maybe a stereotypical rice growing village, unmarked by China's progress at the time. And it was really stunning for me to see.
And you were fortunate that you met some people right away who actually had some familiarity with your family, right?
Exactly. When we got there, people started coming out of their houses, and some of us told them who our father was in the native dialect. And they said, we knew him or knew of him. And at that point, there was an immediate connection and a combination of our native dialect, some Cantonese, a little English. We were able to elicit more impressions and some more memories from, turned out, our distant cousins.
Wow, that's incredible. So you've said that your family's is it to the positive immigration story that began under negative circumstances. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Right. I like to call our story the illegal immigration success story. And by this, I mean that my father, mother, three of my older sisters came to America, entered legally using some fraudulent papers to get around the Chinese Exclusion Act, which was in effect. They had to tell a combination of maybe some falsehoods and then some truths mixed in. So that's what I mean by illegal immigration. And I know that's a controversial term, but in the case of my family and other people at the time, I think it was, to me, an act of civil disobedience against an unjust law. Now, the success story has to do with my father having six girls, one boy, me, and all of his children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren have been able to move into the American mainstream. All of us are productive, taxpaying citizens. So we sort of are a case study of how children of immigrants, even illegal ones, are able to make a good life in America. I think our story can illustrate America should be open to and should be happy about the fact that we remain among all nations in the world a place where so many people want to come.
Mm-hmm. Now, you worked for many years as a journalist at a time when there weren't many Asian Americans in that profession. What was that like?
Well, at the time, I didn't realize I was breaking any barriers because all I wanted to do was practice this new craft that I learned to love when I was in high school and in college. And I had some opportunities in Bay Area newspapers, starting with the San Francisco Chronicle and the San Francisco News Call Bulletin, which no longer exists. But at some point, my identity search kicked in, and I was fortunate that President Kennedy started the Peace Corps. So I said, well, let me take a break from this new craft, see the world a little bit, test myself, and see if I can find my own identity. So I did that. Then after that, I joined the Wall Street Journal and eventually got to the Oakland Tribune, my hometown paper, became a columnist, able to write about my community, among other things. So to me, it was a great learning experience, but I also knew that I wanted to write from the heart as well as the head, and I share some thoughts and stories from my own community as part of the American landscape.
As you know, Asian Americans in our country continue to face discrimination. It spiked during the coronavirus pandemic, and even now we have organizations devoted to stopping Asian American Pacific Islander hate. I'd love to hear your thoughts on why this is such a persistent problem and what should we be doing that we're not already doing?
I wish I had an answer for that. Unfortunately, the history of America's treatment of people of Asian descent is not a very happy one. It goes all the way back to the Gold Rush days, building of the railroad, the Chinese Exclusion Act. But there have been many of us have worked hard to be part of America and are contributors to America. We are good people. There's nothing to fear about us. But, you know, it really kind of depresses me that the recurrence of anti-Asian hate. So the challenge for America remains, what kind of a country and society do we want to be? I prefer for us to be the good America and not the bad America.
Mm-hmm. What do you view as your father's legacy?
Oh, my father's legacy is building four generations of law-abiding Americans who believe in America and the great values, the freedoms that we have, but also some of the old family values that are based on Chinese Confucian values of dignity and honor to the family.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm afraid we have to leave it there. William G. Wong is author of a new book, Sons of Chinatown, a memoir rooted in China and America. Thanks so much for joining us on State of the Bay, Bill.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. We hope you'll join us next Monday at 6 when we'll talk about DEI backlash and the week's Pride celebration. And remember to subscribe to the State of the Bay podcast wherever you listen and never miss an episode. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, you can visit our State of the Bay page on KALW.org. And if you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, let us know. You can email us anytime at stateofthebay@KALW.org. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb and Chris Nooney. Ann Harper was one of the hosts, as you just heard. It was engineered by David Kwan, and Dee Miner was our board operator. Stay tuned for Emergence coming up next. I'm Ethan Elkind. Good night, and thanks for listening.
On the next Throughline from NPR.
Let me distinguish between two major ideas of Zionism. One is a Zionism born out of despair, the reaction to anti-Semitism. And another one is born out, let's call it enthusiasm, meaning we want to revive Jewish culture.
The origins of modern Zionism.
And I will be through line tomorrow afternoon at 5 o'clock here on 91.7 FM and KALW.org. And that's preceded by...
This Week in This American Life, we return to Youssef in Gaza. Since the beginning of the war, he's been the one in his family who's decided this is where we're going next. This is where we're going to stay. This is when we have to go, until he arrived in Rafah, where Youssef hit a wall and could not make a decision. What happened to Youssef and his family is an Israeli invasion of Rafah got closer and closer and then arrived this week.
For This American Life, This American Life, kicking off story time tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock on 91.7 FM and KALW.org.
Hey, this is One Way Possible, your sonic scavenger. It's Monday, and tonight I will be with you from 8 to 10 p.m. So join me and catch a vibe right here on KALW 91.7 FM and KALW.org.